Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years of major league marketing has pretty well assured that we all know Barbie, the best-selling doll whose little feet are always ready for high heels. Fewer know the story of her creator, Ruth Handler, 10th child of Polish-Jewish immigrants who helped found Mattel and build a Barbie empire. She modeled Barbie on a German doll and character who was, more or less, a prostitute, added breasts because she thought girls wanted grown-up play figures, lost a breast to cancer, and spent the rest of her life helping women in the same boat as Barbie sales went on and on. This hour, On Point, the story of Ruth Handler, the woman behind the world's most famous doll. You can join the conversation, What's Your Barbie Story? 50 years on, what's Barbie's legacy and impact on generations now of girls? Joining me now from Santa Barbara, California, is Robin Gerber, author of the new book, Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Robin Gerber, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Introduce us to Ruth Handler.
Well, Ruth Handler is one of the greatest figures in corporate American history who nobody knows about. She was only a young mother with two young children in 1945 when she took the designs of her very brilliant, wonderful artist-designer husband, who was also so shy and retiring he couldn't order dinner in a restaurant. She took his designs and she sold them and started marketing them, and that really was the beginning of Mattel. And by the way, she was not shy about saying, I founded Mattel, and I believe she did.
So she founded a company that's come to be part of America's corporate pantheon. Who was she? Who was this? I mean, 10th child of an immigrant family. What kind of character did she grow up with? What kind of personality did the creator of Barbie have? Was she a little Barbie?
Actually, not really. She was short, although she was quite well endowed. But she wasn't the way we think of Barbie, in that she was intuitively a tremendously smart woman. But it is really, Tom, the great American story. She was the 10th and last child of Polish-Jewish immigrants. They never really spoke English very well. They moved out to the West, to Denver. And she was actually raised by her oldest sister, because her mother, by the time she had her mother was just too ill to raise her. So Ruth was raised by this older sister who was in business herself. She and her husband owned a deli and a liquor store. And Ruth was a little girl always in a hurry to grow up. At 10 years old, she was already working in her sister's store. She describes herself as not really having many friends. She wasn't very interested in other little girls and in playing. She really wanted to be a grown-up herself, and was always very interested in business, and of course saw this great woman in her life, her sister/mother, as a woman who was in business. And I think that was a huge model for her.
I learned so many details. I mean, not that I've paid that much attention to Barbie, but I had no idea that Barbie and Ken were named after anybody's children, let alone the creator. You're right that she actually thought about naming it Babs or Barbara, because that's what they actually called their daughter in those days. And Barbie was available, but she went for that. And that the idea for Barbie itself, the doll, came from watching her daughter play with cutout dolls.
Yes, that is always what she said, and I think that part is true, although the idea coming into her head, I think, did come from her own experience of wanting to be a little girl who grew up. But she watched Barbara play and her friends playing. They were adolescents, and they were playing with these paper dolls that were adult women, of course. And that was the only choice they had. Because if you were a little girl back then in the 50s and you wanted to play with a real doll, the doll you got was a baby doll. And there was only one thing you could fantasize about being with a baby doll, of
being
course,
a mommy.
And that was a mommy. Mm-hmm. Right.
But with Barbie, the idea was this was an image of a teenage budding adult doll that the girls would grow up to be, rather than taking care of the infant.
Yes. Well, budding might be a bit of an understatement. She was
okay.
Already
she was
well
budded,
wasn't she?
I guess.
The great idea about Barbie, and lots of people ask, why has she endured? I think she endured because this was a great big idea. The idea of giving girls a doll that was sort of like a Rorschach for them. They could take it and fantasize about being anything. And while, of course, there's a lot of criticism about Barbie, I know we're going to talk about that. You'll also find many women who say the doll allowed me to pretend to be whoever I wanted to be. And that was exactly what Ruth's idea was. And she never did apologize for that.
This trip to Europe was key in all of this. They were on a family vacation, saw a doll in a window. It was a German. It's described as sex toy. I'm trying to figure out exactly what that means. And it really sent her mind racing. Describe that for us, Robin.
Yes, well, Ruth had been trying for a number of years to get her all-male design team to get their minds around this idea that she wanted this adult doll. And they just kept saying, we can't figure out how to make such a thing. It would be too costly. The plastics won't hold up for such a tiny doll. And besides,
because she wanted it small but with a lot of detail. She wanted the fingernail polish visible, for example. She wanted facial features that weren't just those broad baby doll features, but real sort of sharper, more grown-up features.
Exactly. And she was a stickler for quality. Nothing was half-stepped. It would have to be really good. And her designer said, "We not only can we not do that, but Ruth, mothers will never buy their daughters a doll with breasts. Don't be silly." Well, then she's on this wonderful world tour with her European tour with her children and husband. And they come upon a toy store, a big toy store in Luzern, Switzerland. And there hanging in the window are these dolls that you and I would think of as Barbie dolls. But in fact, they had started their life as the physical embodiment of a cartoon, cartoon character named Lily, which was really, she really was a prostitute, Lily. She took things in exchange for sex. And the cartoonist had this great idea. Gosh, men might really think Lily was a fun little toy to hang from their rear view mirrors and give out at bachelor parties and this kind of thing. And so they produced these dolls, and little girls in Europe said, wait a second, we like those. And so gradually they worked their way into toy stores. And that's when Ruth saw the doll, and she scooped it up, gave one to Barbara, who wanted one, and took two back to Mattel to give to her designers to copy.
So here it is, a German kind of sex joke gag doll, a little sexual hottie, actually a prostitute. She sees it as the model for Barbie. She brings it back home. And then in those days, of course, it's up to, I guess maybe it was inevitable then, that to her staff to go off to Japan to try and get it made. That presented its own kind of interesting challenges.
Well, that was a bit of forward thinking also. It was just the early years of manufacturing in Japan. And so, yeah, she hands it to this engineer she had, a man named Jack Ryan, mm-hmm. who himself was quite a flamboyant character. And he takes it off to Japan to try to figure out how they can actually copy this doll. She wants a better plastic used, a softer plastic, mm-hmm. so the doll's not quite so hard. She's going to soften the features a little bit. But if you look at the two, they are very, very similar. And he gets there and he encounters all of these problems with, first of all, with the molding of this plastic into the fine kind of detail she wants. But also, the Japanese just don't like this doll very much. They think she's very hard-looking. And they also just don't get it that, yes, there should be breasts, but not exactly breasts, because the breasts are not supposed to have nipples. So they keep producing this doll with nipples on its breast. And finally, Jack Ryan, in frustration, just takes a file out of his pocket and just files off the nipples.
His Japanese wasn't so good. So he said, look, this is what I want. And zip, 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 off they go. But the breasts definitely there. And this, of course, in the long legs, super long, and the almost impossible physique, what drew so much fire from feminist critics later, saying this is not a body image that we want to our girls to aspire to, because so few can have it. I saw somewhere that the people estimated if she had been life-size, 5'6 or so, she might have been had measurements of 39-inch chest, 19-inch waist, 33-inch hips, and that's nigh impossible at that length. But she made no apologies about that. What was her thinking?
No, in fact, I think I could hear Ruth having a good laugh about those figures. I don't know if they came out in her lifetime. But no, her thinking was a couple of things. First of all, look, she was copying another doll, and this is not unusual in the toy business, mm-hmm. by the way. It was a lot easier to make this product if you just copied someone else's, and that's what it looked like. So that was the first thing. Secondly, the other huge idea about Barbie was to create a wardrobe for it. The doll that she bought in Europe, the Lily doll, when you bought it, you could only buy it with the outfit it was wearing. And when she asked to buy other outfits, they said, oh, no, you have to buy another doll to get another outfit. Mm-hmm. And she said, she immediately saw that this was stupid and came back and said, we've got to make a couture wardrobe for this doll. And in order for the clothes to look right, we need the doll to look like this. Now, remember, this is all happening in Los Angeles, where, shall we say, the women were not unlike Barbies even back then. Mm-hmm. And Ruth herself, as I said, was quite well endowed. So I don't think she thought for a second that there was anything strange about this. And in fact, of course, the clothes do look rather wonderful on Barbie.
And then when she, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
I was going to say, then when she was criticized, she just dismissed this. I mean, Mattel had been criticized already for making guns. They were a great manufacturer of toy guns mm-hmm. to tie into those Western TV shows in the 50s.
Very realistic-looking guns, more realistic than had been on the market before Mattel.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Again, this quality thing and Elliot's genius in designing the Fanner 50 pistol, some people will remember. Mm-hmm. These were great toys. And when they were criticized for this, Elliot said, look, you know, little boys will pick up a stick and play with that. It's up to parents to deal with these kinds of things. And that was Ruth's response with Barbie as well.
Just incredible. We'll come back and look at the marketing of this. Of course, the marketer and psychologist that they went to, Ernest Dichter, had been sort of what had been scathingly described in The Hidden Persuaders, the big book on how the American public was being manipulated by marketing. He was hired exactly because of that, in part by Ruth Handler. And he came back and said, well, here's my advice. Make Barbie's breasts bigger. Make them bigger. Go with it.
Exactly. You know, in a book of great characters, I think Ernest Dichter is just one of the greatest, a Freudian psychologist from Vienna who comes to the United States. Instead of becoming a psychologist, he goes to companies and he says, look, I can tell you how to sell your products from a psychological perspective. So the first great branding goes on, and he tells companies to sell cars as sex objects for older men and this kind of thing. And same thing with Barbie.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Barbie at 50 and the woman who made her. The first ever Barbie ad aired during Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse Club TV show, 1959. Here's an excerpt.
Barbie, beautiful Barbie, I'll make believe that I am you.
You can tell it's Mattel. It's swell.
That was then, 1959. 50 years later, still the best-selling doll in America. Robin Gerber is with us. She's author of the new book, Barbie and Ruth, The Story of the World's Most Famous Doll and the Woman Who Created Her. She's also written, as I said, about Eleanor Roosevelt and Katharine Graham. She's got Ruth Handler right up there, Barbie's creator, in those ranks here. Of course, Ruth, you remind us in the book that Ken also came out. Ken doll became, in the 90s, a kind of gay icon. And then, ironically, Ruth's son, Ken, the doll's namesake, was a closeted homosexual, died from AIDS in 1994. The story just is a thousand wrinkles to it.
Yes, it's a very sad story. She was extremely close with Ken. He was very much like Elliot, very imaginative, creative.
Elliot, her husband.
But Elliot, her husband. I'm sorry, Elliot, her husband. Yep. And he did keep this a secret right up until almost the end of his life. And, you know, the wonderful thing, I did speak to his doctor, the wonderful thing when Ruth was and Elliot were told, you know, Ruth's reaction was to immediately say, all right, what are we going to do? We've got to do something about this, and just throw herself into trying to help Ken in any way she could. But he did die of AIDS in 1994.
And of course, there's the story, we'll come to it, that Ruth Handler herself had eventually had breast cancer, lost a breast to that, spent much of her later life designing and getting prosthetic breasts to women who in those days didn't have many options when that happened. We'll come to that. Let me take some calls here first. Christina in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Christina, you're on the air with Robin Garber. Gerber.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What's on your mind, Christina?
Well, I am a psychotherapist in Wellesley and a professor of psychology. And my research interest was in female attractiveness. Now, I don't think it was a coincidence that as a little girl growing up, I had about nearly 40 Barbie dolls. I rejected the traditional baby doll, but I just loved Barbies. And it's interesting that today, the research on female attractiveness, the creator of Barbie intuitively knew what research is now bearing out.
What do you mean by that, Christina?
Well, what I mean is what seems to be attractive in women, according to women and men, is something called the highly estrogenized face, which means the feature, you know, if you think of a traditionally masculinized male adult, there is the thick brow.
Uh-huh.
The estrogenized face has a rounded, smooth forehead, large eyes, and then the face drapes down a little bit and comes to a point rather than has a strong jaw. So the nose is smaller and the chin and the lips are full, but the chin is small.
So it's Barbie.
It is Barbie, but it's not just, you know, an infantilized face of large eyes like a baby. There's also the sexual element, which, if taken together, that's the extremes. The extreme ultimate female is that at once there is something soft and feminine and estrogen-like and vulnerable like a baby, but also very sexual.
So as a psychotherapist, what do you make of Barbie? You loved her as a girl. You grew up to be a psychotherapist. You know the complaints about body image that come in here, about sexualization of children. Here's Mattel with guns and sexy dolls that they made a mint selling to American kids.
Right.
What do you make of that?
You know, I'm going to venture something that's perhaps politically incorrect, that while it may be a shame and create a lot of problems for women, I think that we're just simply hardwired, that men and women across cultures view attractiveness as something having to do with traditional femininity and sexualization, whether it's large breasts, small waist, that there are certain proportions, facial features and body proportions, that's just what traditionally we seem drawn to, for better or worse.
Christina, let us hold that thought. We're going to test that with a sociologist in a moment. Let me get a couple more calls here real quick. Judy in Nashville, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Glad to speak to you.
You too.
I wanted to tell you my favorite daughter story. She's 18 now, but when she was very young, we had very few Barbies, only because we didn't want to stereotype the body image.
Mm-hmm.
She was given some for gifts, and her friends had many of them. As she grew up and started to go into puberty, I can't believe that she was referring to her emerging breasts as her Barbies.
Well,
true. It's my favorite funny story about our Willa.
Maybe we can believe it. Let us hold that. That's funny. Let us hold that as well. Let's get another call right here from Boston. We have a call from Barbie. Barbie, you're on the air. Are you kidding?
Well, I'm glad to know who ruined my life, Mrs. Handler, because I was born a Barbie, and I stayed a Barbie through college, but when I became a professional, I couldn't be a Barbie anymore because people just snickered. So
now, what do you mean you were born a Barbie? You were born with high heels
Barbie,
or your feet ready to put them on?
No. I was a Barbara, but my nickname was Barbie all the way through college.
Yeah.
But when I became professional, I couldn't call up people and say, hi, this is Barbie, because all I got is Snickers, so I had to become Barbara, and I hate it. It's formidable. It's old-fashioned. It's like Betty. It's scary. And I'm not that way.
What about Babs? I guess that's a little old-fashioned, too.
Babs. Oh, Babs is so worse. And then I have a friend who's Italian, and she said, oh, there's the most marvelous name in Italian for you. I said, what is it? She said, Barbarella. I said, I don't think that's going to work in the U.S.
You were pushed
to
the pushed off your own nickname by the dolls. Barbie, thank you very much for your calling. And, hey, let it fly. Robin Gerber, you hear these three. Our psychotherapist who says it's hardwired. Our caller in Nashville who says her daughter was calling her own budding breasts Barbies. And then Barbie who couldn't have the name. This is a doll for whatever it is, how many inches tall, with a lot of sway, a lot of throw weight.
Yes, this is comments on the cultural phenomena I hadn't heard before. And I thought the psychologist's comments were quite interesting. And, you know, it's true that Barbie tapped into something that Ruth seemed to understand intuitively. And as she said, seems to be being borne out, although I know there are people who would dissent with that.
Let's bring another voice in here for a moment, if I may. From Newton, Massachusetts, we're joined by Charlene Hess-Biber, professor of sociology at Boston College and author of Am I Thin Enough Yet? The Cult of Thinness and the Commercialization of Identity. Charlene Hess-Biber, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Your thoughts on Barbie at 50 and American womanhood, I guess.
Well, not all feminists hate Barbie. I don't think it's an either-or kind of thing. I think Barbie turning 50 is still going strong, and it says something about its appeal to women and young girls across, you know, across this land and beyond. You know, Barbie dolls are sold three, maybe every minute, every second, actually. And, you know, the impressive thing about Barbie is while she doesn't more or less change her shape, she's had an impressive career, set of careers, more like 108 professions, as well as never losing that what our callers are talking about, her femininity, her traditional femininity. She's smart and she's sexy, and she can chat about fashion. She can make friends, and she can become a surgeon. She can have it all. And I think especially if we look at during 1959, just a short number of years later, we had the second wave of feminism. We had the message that women can be anything they want to be. The notion of empowerment, breaking down the mind-body dichotomy. So Barbie fit in to sort of that message that young women were receiving during that decade.
But you and others have written about the downside of this hyper-slender model.
Yes.
You wrote, Am I Thin Enough Yet? I'm looking here at a report of a study out of the University Central Hospital in Helsinki, Finland, that she would, if a 5 foot six or so adult had her proportions, she would lack the 17 to 22% body fat required for a woman to menstruate.
Right.
Maybe it's urban legend, but everybody knows the story that if Barbie were, of a real adult size, she couldn't even stand up with those dimensions. What about it?
Exactly. She'd be about 110 pounds, and on her tippy toes, she would fall over. The problem is, I think we have to differentiate the kind of individualized play of Barbie and the corporate Barbie. And the corporate Barbie is pushing it's pushing consumerism. It's pushing for profit. It's creating an image that's unattainable. And to attain it, you have to buy, try, or comply with a range of other products. So basically, it's become pushed as an ideal that others should live up to. If you're Barbie, you can be anything you want to be. But the message is, you got to be a certain body. So this idea of being anything you want to be is attached. It has a price, and creating tremendous amount of body anxiety.
But why should that price be there? That you can be anything you want to only if you're built like Barbie? I mean, that seems a really artificial construct.
Well, think about it. I mean, I think, and if you look at women who you ask women how are they feeling, and most of how women are feeling in terms of their self-esteem, their self-worth, is more and more directly gained by how much they weigh, not necessarily what degrees, they have. More and more our sense of self as women is tied to becoming a certain kind of body.
But that seems straight up at odds with what you can be anything you want to be meant.
Well, that's the catch. You can be anything you want to be if you're Barbie. Appearance, we know, is a strong selective factor for social and economic success, and increasingly weight has become a very big part of what it means to get at these goodies.
Robin Gerber, I want to hear your view on this. Let's hear just a little bit, though, from an ad. This is from 1987. Barbie, ultimately, we're all kinds of Barbies. This is Dr. Barbie trading in her stilettos for a stethoscope here, but Ken still very much part of the picture.
Dr. Barbie's into making her patients feel good. She's into checking them out like a doctor would. She's into changing fast. For days with Dr. Ken, we're into it too. Again and again, we're into Barbie.
We're into Barbie.
Okay, she's a doctor, Robin Gerber, but she's still, Barbie, and she's still into dates with Dr. Ken, and she's into Barbie. What about this? You can be anything you want to be, but you got to look like Barbie.
Yeah, well, I don't think certainly it wasn't Ruth's idea that you had to look like Barbie, and I don't know if that's Mattel's idea today. That just is what the doll is. But I think this whole idea of the doll changing careers is really interesting, because I think that was really the company following what the children were doing. And so Ken came along because little girls demanded within a year of the doll coming out, hey, we want a boyfriend for our Barbies. And then, of course, they were playing with these dolls as all kinds of things. And I actually brought along from your own show, This I Believe. There's a fashion
on
designer,
NPR.
Jane.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, on NPR, This I Believe. Fashion designer Jane Hamill wrote that her little blonde-haired, blue-eyed Malibu Barbie that she loved didn't look anything like her red-haired, freckled self. But that didn't stop me from thinking I was just like Barbie, cool and independent and smart. And only as an adult I realized that my belief in Barbie is really a belief in my own imagination, in whoever I imagined I could be and whatever I imagined I could do.
This I believe. Wow. And my belief in Barbie. What a phrase. Let me take a call right here, if I may, from Lynn in Charlestown, Massachusetts. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
I'm just loving this show. And I bought my first Barbie in 1959 when she first came out. I was 7 years old.
Early adopter.
Oh, yeah. I had to earn the money to purchase my own Barbie. She was $3 at the time. So I presented my $3 in dimes, which is what I earned for all my household chores.
Right.
But, you know, I knew that Barbie was a doll. I never aspired to be like her physically, even though I loved the glamorous clothes. But for me, even at the age of 7, what Barbie represented to me was this feeling of being able, as a young girl, to aspire to other things to do with my life besides, you know, the traditional gender-specific careers, even though I know back then, you know, Barbie was a stewardess, Barbie was a nurse, you know, none of the non-traditional careers were available for Barbie, but still, she was so independent, even though she was portrayed as a teenager. You know, she was a lot like Nancy Drew. You know, she had her own car. She even had her own house. I mean, you know, she's 16 years old. Where are her parents?
And are you sure? Of course, that's empowering right there. But are you sure that the body image didn't?
You can do whatever you want, and, you know, you don't have to worry about your parents. So,
yeah.
You know, to me, Barbie really represented independence and possibility. And, you know, I still have a couple Barbies, and, you know, I still enjoy, you know, dressing them up and so forth. But, you know, that's more nostalgia than anything else. But,
hey, Lynn, you know, thanks very much for your call and observations there. Just got Charlene for another second here. Charlene,
yeah.
Is this really it? Are we so postmodern that now the Barbie figure is just A-OK, girls aspire for that, to be that? I mean, have we really sort of dropped the whole concern about girls aspiring to an impossible figure and having miserable adulthoods because who can actually look like Barbie?
Again, I think you have to look at corporate body and what's being pushed versus individuals' embodiment.
What's the difference? It's a doll made by a corporation that ends up in a girl's hands.
The issue is, it's not just about Barbie. It's about the range of other kinds of products that are being pushed with the same kind of message.
Does that make it better? I mean, I don't care.
From magazines, advertising, fitness clubs, the ideal weight is significantly less than what is medically desirable. You know, the ultra-thin ideal is not just promoted by Barbie. It's been promoted by the diet industry, cosmetic industry, toy health, mass media. And there's a range of products, dieting products, slimming products, exercising products, because we want, you know, to get that set of ideals. It's not just embodied in Barbie. We need to buy, try, and comply. We have to have an ideal we can't attain because we need to buy something to attain it. And ironically, the more we buy, you know, as a culture, the fatter we're getting. There's a connection between thin Barbie and fat Barbie.
Charlene Hess Biber, I know I have to let you go, author of Am I Thin Enough? Thank you very much
for
being with us, Charlene. I don't know.
Barbie
may still be the sharp end tip of that spear. Robin Gerber, author of Barbie and Ruth, about Ruth Handler, the creator of Barbie. Please stand by in Santa Barbara, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Barbie at 50 and the woman who made her. My guest is Robin Gerber. She's written about Katharine Graham and Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, about Ruth Handler, the new book is Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. The message in this 1984 ad here was, Barbie, you, your daughter, can do anything. Here's the ad campaign.
We girls can do anything, right, Barbie?
We're pretending Barbie's traveling and she's only taking Barbie fashion.
In jogging clothes for a morning run.
In one.
Feeling off, dressed for action. At the big ball, she's the main attraction.
Spectacular.
We girls can do anything, right, Barbie?
We've got jogging clothes, morning run, disco gear, rocking fun. We girls can do anything. Robin Gerber, you quote Ruth Handler, Barbie's creator, saying, telling a reporter, Barbie is a very educational product. The children learn color coordination, fashion design, good grooming, hairstyling, good manners, people relationships. I mean, this hardly sounds like exactly the liberated woman, but I guess she didn't care.
Well, no, she was selling a product, wasn't she? And she had hired Ernest Dichter, the psychologist who's into branding, for no small amount of money to tell her exactly how to market this doll. And he came back after doing his focus groups, talking to mothers, talking to children, watching them play with the doll. And he said, here's what you have to do. You have to market this doll as a teenage fashion model, because then you can say to the mothers, the doll will teach your daughters good grooming, and that will get them over this problem they have with the doll's breasts. So she was following the company line.
Good grooming, and off we go. Let's take a call from Adam in Somerville, Massachusetts. Adam, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
I'm calling as kind of a slightly concerned father. I have two young children, 4 and about 2.5, and they're beginning this love affair with Barbie. I'm not so concerned on the basics. You know, I know that it's not critical that I insulate them from so much and just keep dialogue going about body image and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But personally, as an adult male, my girls are at this phase now where they love to just strip all their dolls. So I have like a box full of naked women on the floor of my house or strewn about the house. And, you know, the design of these dolls is designed to trigger responses, right? So you guys talked about proportions and how that triggers responses.
And your daughters are 4 and 2.5, so you're thinking...
4 and 2.5, and they're running around with these dolls that I'm looking at them, and I'm sort of enjoying them for the wrong reasons, right? And my children are having a great time with them, and they're all very empowered, and they don't have any illusions about, you know, a lot of this stuff. They're probably just too young for that at this point anyway. But I'm calling for hopefully some reassurance because, you know, are my daughters going to grow up to be pole dancers? What's going on here? I mean, right. I have naked women strewn about. I don't put naked women on my wall, you know.
Right, right.
They're strewn about my apartment right now.
Right, and these are more than anatomically correct. Robin Gerber, I mean, it's a good-humored question, but it's at the same time, it's a real question. Now, 1 billion-plus of these dolls sold, somehow humankind survives, but that doesn't mean that it's not planting expectations, images? How have you come to look at a question like Adam's?
Well, yes, and Adam, I had a daughter also, and she played with Barbies, and I had the same concerns. I think many parents do. And by the way, you've confirmed for us that the Lily doll was, in fact, doing what she was supposed to do. But as far as Barbie with little girls, I think that she does help little girls to fantasize about what they want to be, but can she also give them the wrong messages? There is this inherent sexist contradiction in this doll. That is that she could give them messages about their bodies that you don't want them to have. And I think that's where the parents' role comes in always encouraging them and not saying anything bad about how they look as they grow up. And I certainly focused on that as my daughter grew into her teenage years. And I like to think at 27, she's perfectly well-adjusted about that, and she had plenty of Barbies.
Let's get a call from Sarasota, Florida, and another father, maybe. Kevin. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hi. Interesting. I love your show, and it's interesting to me that I choose to finally call in when we're talking about dolls here.
You're welcome on any subject, Kevin. What do you think?
Well, I have daughters from 30 down to 7, so Barbie's been a huge fixture in our house for a long time, still is. Have some beautiful collector Barbies on display that my daughter's just in love with. But I'm heard recently that Mattel sued whatever company is putting out the little competitor, the Bratz dolls, which mm-hmm. my daughter loves as well and has several of those. Bratz seems to, you know, push the envelope a little more with sexuality and whatnot and image, but I don't tend to worry about that kind of thing with my kids' toys too much. We teach them values and let them play with what they will. But I was wondering if your guest had thoughts or insights as to why they chose to sue over this and what the creator would think about suing another toy manufacturer.
Yeah, Barbie versus Bratz dolls. There's quite a story there. Robin Gerber, do you know it? Have you kept up? I've got some of the outline of it here, but what do you know, Robin?
Yes, I have. And actually, I spoke to Isaac Larian, who is the president of MGA, which makes the Bratz dolls. And ironically, and as he said, Ruth would probably have liked him. I'm sure she would. He's actually a Jewish-Iranian immigrant to this country, came here with $700 and built this huge company. But unfortunately for him, I think Ruth would have absolutely agreed with what Mattel did, which was protect its brand. And the Carter Bryant, who actually designed the Bratz doll, was doing it while he was at Mattel. And so they actually owned the rights to that doll. And that's what they were fighting over. And let me tell you, toys is one competitive business, and Ruth fought for her doll, her toys at every turn.
Now, I don't know that much about Bratz dolls, but they're even a more kind of sexualized in-your-face doll, I guess.
They're more exaggerated features.
And what MGA Entertainment launched them in 2001, and then Mattel sued for $500 million, alleging that their Bratz creator, Carter Bryant, as you say, was working for Mattel when he developed the idea for Bratz. And I'm reading here that a jury found Mattel would have to be paid $100 million in damages. That just last December, December 3rd, 2008, U.S. District Judge Stephen Larson banned MGA from selling Bratz, allowed them to sell through the holiday season. But as of yesterday, February 11th, 2009, again, I don't know, I can't vouch for all this, but that they would have to stop selling Bratz dolls. Is that right? Do you know?
That's right. It's a stunning victory for Mattel, actually an almost unprecedented victory in terms of this kind of law. But as I said, I think that Ruth would have done absolutely the same thing. She had her very first toy, the Yuka Doodle, that Mattel made, was stolen by Knickerbocker Toys back then in the mid-40s. And she learned her lesson about that you have to make toys that are not easily copied by other companies, because that's often how toys get made.
She was litigious, and as you write, she was a tough cookie, spouting four-letter words, quite imperious. What was that side of Barbie's creator?
Well, I don't think you found a company like this unless you have a lot of faith in yourself, and she did. She had rock-solid faith in herself, and you have to be tough because it's a very tough business. You have to go out there and take huge risks, like borrowing lots of money. You know, this current economic crisis, I think about Ruth because she was, in the early years of Mattel, always struggling to get money from banks, and if banks hadn't lent money, there wouldn't have been a Mattel toy company. So there was that, and also what was great about her as an entrepreneur, and remember, we're talking about a woman who didn't even have a year of college education, mm-hmm. no business education, mm-hmm. totally did this on her own smarts. She never shied away. In fact, she sought out the best and the brightest in business and hired from the top schools. And when I interviewed these people, even today, they were some of the most hugely creative and interesting people I'd ever met, and they were fiercely loyal to her. They thought she was a tremendous boss because she let them be creative and do what the best they could do.
You also suggest in a way that Mattel wouldn't have been anything like it is, certainly Barbie, without the advent of television. This was one of the first companies to really get into television advertising, first for its realistic guns, but very much for Barbie with the Mickey Mouse Club show and all the rest.
Yes, exactly. Well, in fact, we have Ruth to thank for something that I think most parents won't thank her for, and that is turning around the way toys were actually bought. Before 1955, when the Mickey Mouse Club started, toy makers would sell their toys in catalogs mostly, just before Christmas, and the catalogs were aimed at parents, not at children at all. Well, in 1955, Disney came along with this new show, Mickey Mouse Club, and Ruth's public relations company came to her and said, look, you can advertise on this new show, but you have to do it for a whole year, which toy companies had never done, and you have to put up $500,000. Mm. Well, that was the whole net worth of her company.
Mm-hmm.
But she went for it. Like I said, great risk taker. And that really launched her ahead of the biggest toy company then was Marks. And by the way, it's a funny thing. Mr. Marks was on the cover of Time that year and quoted as saying, toys will never be successfully sold through television.
How wrong can you be? She pushed hard, ultimately too hard, got into legal trouble later in her life with Mattel. Describe that for us.
Yes. Well, as I said, she was hugely competitive. This really had nothing to do with money. But in 1970, we're now talking about a company that in 1970 was worth $300 million.
A lot of money.
She really
money,
didn't.
Then.
A and, lot.
And
of
now,
money.
But especially then, yeah.
Yes. And she really believed that toys simply couldn't grow any bigger. And she wanted to grow the company. She was very competitive. And so she started buying up other companies, including Ringling Brothers Circus, a movie company that made the movie Sounder, a lot of us will remember. But she was buying these companies with stock. Mattel stock was very high flying. Well, right around that time, the company had a bad quarter, another bad quarter. And so to hide the profit loss from Wall Street, she cooked the books. And this was discovered, and she was pushed out of Mattel in the mid-70s, eventually convicted of fraud, given the longest white-collar criminal service sentence, community service sentence ever given up to that time. And frankly, Tom, I think the judge took pity on her because as this was all going on, she, as you said, had gotten breast cancer and lost a breast in 1970.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, then made a kind of second career, though not such a big money career, out of prosthetic breasts for women, including some very high-profile women in this country.
It is a great story of redemption. As she herself said, many people would have crawled into a hole or, you know, just hid themselves away. She could not do that. Elliot begged her to just stay home and relax. No way. She went to find a prosthetic for herself because reconstruction wasn't commonly done then. And they were just these globs that looked terrible. And she liked to look good. And so she found the best sculptor she could for prosthetics, and she brought in some of her Mattel designers, and they designed a natural-looking breast for women, prosthetic breast. And she started marketing these in salons at Neiman Marcus and Nordstrom. She insisted that every member of the staff be personally trained in how to do this and created a core of other women like herself. She called them mastectomies, EE at the end, and went around personally fitting women all over the country and having this wonderful experience that Ruth Handler had never had before of women just hugging her and crying and thanking her for helping them to get some of their dignity back.
Did she see irony in having been the one who brought the buxom doll to market then being in this circumstance or not?
She absolutely did. She actually had a great sense of humor. In fact, she would go on television shows and throw open her blouse and challenge the host to discover which breast wasn't the real one. So she was completely intrepid. And yes, when they pointed out that irony to her, she would say, well, yes, I just went from breast to breast.
Boy, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a few more calls if we can. Deborah, West Roxbury, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just calling to talk a little bit about the Barbie doll. When I was a girl, I had many Barbies. My grandmother even made clothes for her for them because I had so many. And my Barbies were car mechanics that repaired the Barbie car. My Barbie was a pirate queen, and she often would battle G.I. Joe for domination of the United States.
Oh, boy.
And Barbie was a paratrooper and used to parachute using Kleenex for parachutes and all this. And my point was, as little girls, my friends, when we would play Barbie, we knew she wasn't real. We knew that the body was actually sort of humorous, and we would laugh about it. It didn't matter. And I think the adults sort of put more emphasis on it than the girls did, because even though she may not have looked real, what was mattering was what she was doing and not the fact that her body was not accurate.
Deborah, thanks for that report. And I read here that there was a group in the 90s called the Barbie Liberation Organization, went around with talking Barbies, modified their voice box, put the sort of G.I. Joe speech into these Barbies so that parents would buy them, and then the Barbies would say, "Eat lead, Cobra," or "Vengeance is mine." Let's get a call from Terry in San Francisco, California. Terry, you're on the air. Our time is short, but what do you know, Terry?
Quickly, my Barbie story. I'm a commercial photographer with a studio in San Francisco. I've been doing this a long time. I was shooting an annual report for Consolidated Freightways, who at the time was distributing Barbie. We were ready to photograph Barbie. There's actually 12 of them that we were going to photograph. Identical Barbies, identical clothing. And in the studio shows up two stylists from Mattel who work strictly on Barbie, period.
Because they wanted your Barbies to look just right, even though it wasn't even their shoot?
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Barbie had to look a specific way. When I then asked them how much this product was worth in that era, and this was probably late 80s, early 90s,
yeah.
They said it was a $1 billion sale that year. I went, well, they could have sent a 747 full of stylists.
Right. Terry, thanks for the call. Our time is so short. Robin, I'm reading here, Barbie at one time basically had 90% of the fashion doll market, they call it. Now maybe 60%. What's that about? Is Barbie losing her throne or sharing it?
Well, she's lost the market share, and Bratz actually eclipsed Barbie in some countries, I think in the UK. So I think Mattel was quite relieved when they won that lawsuit. But she's still having a very strong run. If maybe she's only selling 2 dolls per second instead of 3.
But Lawyer Barbie has won the lawsuit, so maybe she'll be back in that high spot soon. what a story. Ruth Handler and the creation of the doll Barbie. Robin Gerber's new book is Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Robin, thanks so much for being with us. Fascinating story. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We'll go out with Aqua's 1997 song, Barbie. Lawsuit around that, too. Well, you've got to take care of your Barbies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.